This is On the Other Hand.
A podcast that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community members who are working with others across the political divide. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas, part of a national organization that aims to reduce political polarization by promoting honest and respectful dialogue among people of all political beliefs.
We had a great conversation, Glenn, in our previous episode. You and I compared our reactions to and thoughts about some excerpts from a recent discussion that you had with retired psychologist Dr. Jerry Henderson. In those episodes, you were talking about research and theories concerning political polarization. And in this follow-up episode, we're going to continue that conversation with Glenn White and with myself as we share perspectives across the political divide. Are we ready to go to the next one?
This next excerpt is going to be fairly short, I think. Jerry's just basically summarizing his view of the research on cognitive and physiological differences between conservatives and liberals.
All right, I'll get it pulled up here.
So in summary, among political conservatives, the cognitive and physiological studies demonstrate greater negativity bias, sense of threat, and emphasis on formal group membership compared to political liberals exposed to similar stimuli. So there are differences, and I think it's all consistent with what we've been talking about of the parasite stress theory, that conservatives just tend to have a little more focus. They're better at picking up threat cues than than liberals are.
Okay.
All right, Glenn, you're going to have to tell us what the parasite stress theory is. I think you might have covered it earlier in one of the episodes that you and Jerry did together. But for those who haven't listened to that, what is that?
Right. Yeah, that the parasite stress theory is basically people who've been doing the research and looking at how things develop in various ways with the with group membership, with, you know, response to threat and fear. It's basically, and it's quite consistent and well regarded in the community of researchers who do this work. It's basically saying that people early on in history were faced with a very difficult environment of survival in this dangerous wilderness with lots of dangers everywhere, and that included not only dangers from, you know, big scary animals, it also included diseases that could wipe entire tribes out. And so people learned back then that if you stayed within your tribe, you would be safe because you all shared a similar kind of immunity against, you know, disease. I mean, they obviously didn't understand it in those terms, but they knew if they got with that somebody from that other tribe, you know, a couple of miles away, somebody who did got sick and died and caused some other people in their tribe to get sick and die. So they learned to stay away from people they didn't know. They learned to avoid people who were different from them. And so that was a survival thing that the brain evolved to, you know, have group memberships and to reject and be fearful of other groups with which you're not familiar and who are different. It had a good survival value to do that. But as we've gotten more civilized and that becomes less of an issue, the parasites don't, you know, we don't have to worry about that so much. We still, our brain maintains that tendency to immediately see someone who's a different group or who's unfamiliar, who has something odd or different about them, to be suspicious and to be kind of hands off and not want to be around them. So that's what that parasite stress theory is about. And it's meant to help explain why people with different political beliefs or members of different parties or things like that, or even different languages or different skin color, whatever, tend to have kind of almost an automatic negative reaction against people like that because of something that worked at one point in our early history that maybe isn't so helpful anymore.
Okay, that makes sense. And I understand a little bit about tribalism from having listened to some of your other work that you and Jerry have on our podcast. So is Jerry saying here that there's a difference between the formal group membership, the role of that between in terms of the research between conservatives and liberals?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Is there an equal draw for the tribes for both conservatives and liberals in terms of the research?
I think there's the tendency in all people, conservatives, liberals, whatever else. I think the point here, though, is that if you compare conservatives as a group and liberals as a group, that conservatives, because of the research we've already talked about, have a greater tendency, an immediate tendency to be hold people who are different as a potential threat and to be a little more standoffish and cautious than liberals as a group.
Okay. Who knows if, certainly, again, we're not saying that all conservatives are like this or all liberals are like this. I think I'm only guessing here, but I don't know this to be true in terms of the research. But I'm guessing the more, Pew did this recent study in which they tried to divide out different kinds of conservatives and different kinds of liberals. And I was looking primarily at the conservative side of things because I've always kind of wondered where do I fit in this kind of continuum of conservatism. And then also, where does a person fit in terms of a continuum of liberalism? And I wonder if the research might bear out that the people who are more to the farthest right or the farthest left might fit more into that resistance, both sides. But I don't know if there's research.
You're absolutely right. And that's actually another piece that I talk about in one of the other episodes.
Well,
the research on extremism, both sides.
We'll hold on to that then.
Spoiler alert. Extremists on both sides have a lot in common.
Okay. Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking. Well, I don't really have much to add to that segment. I think it was kind of a summary segment. So should we go ahead to the next one?
Because this next one actually reflects some of the things we were talking about. And it's very quick, too. So you can go ahead and play it. It's not long at all.
Okay. And I think you're talking about research on personality differences here, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, let's get this one started.
Okay, let's move on and talk a little bit about, I think we've talked enough about, differences between liberals and conservatives. There are other personality differences. Liberals are higher on openness to experience according to a pretty well-developed personality theory, whereas conservatives are higher on conscientiousness.
Hey, I like that. I'm conscientious. I'll take that any day. I want to be open too, but seriously, I would love to hear a little bit more about those two characteristics. So maybe you can tell us.
Yeah, I'll do that. I was at the time. I was kind of it was almost a throwaway comment, but I had meant to say more about that, so I'll do that here. So basically, in the research that's been done for many decades in psychology and the social sciences, one of the personality, research has had lots of different ways of trying to think about what constitutes personality and what kind of personality flavors are there and things like that. Well, for a number of years now, there's been pretty widespread agreement in the community that this one personality model that's called the Big Five or the five-factor model of personality is seen as the definitive explanation of personality. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't nuances here and there and it's more complicated, but generally it says you can break personality attributes down into five major factors. And so one of those, let's just take the two mentioned here without complicating with the others. Openness to experience is one of the broad categories of personality tendency, and the other is conscientiousness. Now it's a little more broad definition than you might think just from the words that we're using here, but basically, the research that's been done on personality differences between conservatives and liberals has found pretty consistently, again, as a group, not every individual, but as a group, liberals tend to score higher than conservatives on openness to experience. What does that mean? It means that liberals tend to be more open to new ideas and new people and new experiences than conservatives as a group. Conservatives tend to be different from liberals when it comes to conscientiousness. They score consistently higher than liberals on conscientiousness. That means they have a greater tendency to follow rules, group norms, laws, to work and get things done and things like that. So that's kind of what that bit of research is talking about. Now, I do want to make the point that before people think that, well, that means liberals are just really bad because, you know, they're higher on openness. They'll listen to anything. They'll do anything. And whereas conservatives are much more conscious, we follow the laws and rules. Okay. And that's one way to look at it. And there is some truth to that to some degree, but there are both good and bad attributes for each factor. So for instance, let's say openness to experience. A person who is higher in openness to experience is more open to developing relationships with people who are different. They're more likely to be willing to learn new ways of looking at things. They are more likely to explore and check out something new and unfamiliar despite potential danger and therefore discover things. They're more maybe creative and willing to look at things differently. So maybe they're doing some good things in terms of art. So there are a lot of ways in which openness to experience is good. It can also be bad because, you know, what's that saying about you can, if you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for anything. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. So you could look at it that way too. So there are both potential positives and negatives of openness to experience. Same thing with conscientiousness. Conscientiousness obviously sounds good, and it generally is in some ways because it means you're going to follow the rules more, which means you're going to get along better in groups. You're going to be less likely to rock the boat. But it also means that if you're conscientious, you may be less willing to explore something different or to accept someone who is different. You may be less creative. You may be more vulnerable to following group norms even when those group norms become problematic. So it's not a matter of, you know, one group's better or worse than the other because of their higher or lower. It's just descriptive that they have a different behavioral tendency.
This is really interesting. I'm glad that you explained that better, you know, more than just that short segment that we were listening to. And I can only speak for myself. And that's one of the things that I would say as I think about these things. And I really like to think about, you know, rather than making broad strokes. And I know broad strokes help us be able to understand other people. But if we just rely on the broad strokes of explaining something, then sometimes it can be so easy to fall into that stereotyping, especially if we're not open to having conversations with the others. I mean, I loved how you pointed out the negative part of both of those, openness and conscientiousness, those personality traits. And I know I'm speak for me personally, I don't have any idea if it's because I'm you know, conservative. I think there are things in my brain going on that are causing this. But yeah, this rings true for me personally. I can't speak for all conservatives, but I do tend to don't like to rock the boat. I do tend to follow rules. I have to actually work on trying to force myself to get away from more perfectionist tendencies. I know you didn't mention perfectionism as part of this, but I'm thinking about conscientiousness. And the openness, I really have to work on it. I was telling my students the other day that when I go into a conversation that I think is going to be difficult, I need to do something physical sometimes to actually have open hands. And I've mentioned this before on our broadcast and in other Braver Angels workshops and things that I do. But having open hands where it reminds me that I can approach this conversation with curiosity, that I can approach this person with a sense of wonderment. What is this person going to be like? That I can just not label them as one thing. And so, you know, I was thinking, kind of drawing in my head, and actually on the piece of paper also in front of me, you know, this might be kind of a quadrant thing where you've got, you know, on one axis you've got openness and it kind of ranges from high to low, and another axis you've got conscientiousness that ranges from high to low, and all of us probably range on a continuum of high to low. And there might be, you know, a person a person that would be highly conscientious and highly open, although those seem like they could be contradictory. And, you know, a person that's not conscientious and not open, I don't know if that's possible. But anyway, it's making me think about some things. So thank you, Glenn.
Yeah. Welcome to the world of personality research. It's complicated. Well, I tell you what, at this point, those are the excerpts that I wanted to get to, or that you actually wanted to separate out from the rest of the podcast episodes. But I did take out some other couple of excerpts where Jerry or I or both talk about some potential critiques of the research that we're talking about, that this is based on. And this is what a good scientist does. We try to acknowledge the potential weaknesses or questions that remain in any area. So I do have a couple of pieces there. So if you'd like to, we could go ahead and listen to that now and then discuss kind of some of the issues and questions surrounding the research.
I love to critique science, so let's go with it. I'll play this next one.
You know, one of the things, a lot of this is based upon a lot of research that's been done for a few decades now, and from my understanding of what the criticism of the research is, there's always, you know, different scientists who will, you know, argue back and forth. That's what science does. But I think they're making the point that this research has been primarily done by academics with a liberal viewpoint, and so they tend to spend a lot of time investigating and exploring conservative issues. And so the criticism there has been that, well, maybe we don't have a well-rounded view of things. Maybe we need to do more research from conservative-oriented academicians and researchers who will look at liberal stuff. Now, I know that that's there's been some stuff done looking at both liberals and conservatives, and just because, you know, there may be more liberals doing the research than conservatives doesn't mean that their basic methodological foundations are wrong. So if you do conduct a good, solid, scientifically informed study, it can stand on its own, whatever your personal beliefs are. But I think that is one of the criticisms I think it's important to mention, that, you know, probably would benefit from having more diversity in the populations that are studied in the future. And I think they're already moving in that direction, as I understand it.
And I think it's possible that that's more true for personality testing and research than it is for brain scans, because it's a little harder to make, you know, if this lights up, then it lit up.
That's a very good point. So yeah. What you've actually primarily been talking about is based on physiological measures, and that's not the kind of thing you can really fake very well or be influenced by.
No, and you're not necessarily sorting for it, because you're just getting volunteers into your laboratory.
Yeah. So you make a good point. So where the criticism may be better directed is toward the research that looks at personality differences.
And probably moral foundations theory well.
Yeah. Okay, so both of those areas may be more susceptible to some criticism for being incomplete in how they study people and who they study.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good point. Thank you.
It may be important to point out that those are very much generalities.
Yeah.
That sometimes they're researching people kind of on the far right and the far left to pick up these. And they're not deterministic.
You know, that's a good point. And let me make the point broader, that the way science works in most cases is particularly in social sciences, we measure groups,
right.
You know, and we change a variable to measure the outcome. Now, the group difference may well be highly significant and indicate some tendency there. But the other argument is that there are always individuals who are outliers in each group. So it doesn't necessarily apply to each individual in the group, but rather the group as a whole tends in that direction. So there are always going to be exceptions. That's true.
Sure.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Well, there's quite a bit of things here that I would like to talk about, but I think maybe you need to, I think it might be helpful. He mentioned one thing about personality and moral differences being where there might be differences, moral foundation research.
Right.
And
Right.
People who haven't listened to your earlier podcast might not know what that is. So
yeah,
you want to define
important.
That.
That's another one of those things that suffers from lack of context. So the moral foundation comment he mentioned is based on the research that some people who specialize in looking at moral reasoning and moral development in the social sciences. I was best informed about this by reading the book The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, a psychologist, and he for a while was really one of the major researchers in moral foundations. And it's just the current way of looking at moral reasoning and moral judgment. It basically says that moral foundations, they call them moral foundations, they're basic ways of making judgments about what is moral and what isn't. What influences our moral decision making? Let's see, for instance, one way of thinking about a moral situation is harm or, the degree to which some decision or behavior could result in harm for a person. Another moral foundation may be fairness. Is a decision or behavior fair to multiple people, or is it, favoring one side over the other? There are a number of others that I won't get into, but that's the general idea. So I think Jerry's big point was that in both personality research and moral foundations research, because they are based on these theoretical constructs of how we think and how we act based on certain tendencies, and they do that. I mean, there's been a lot of research done, and they have some pretty solid ways of looking at that, but it's still something that it's not the same as looking at your brain's responsiveness to certain stimuli. They may be more open to bias or more open to misinterpretation of what the results mean. So does that help?
Yes, thank you. That's perfect. I just knew that some of our listeners might not have listened to those other podcasts, right, which we hope they do, but to get that clarification. You mentioned Jonathan Haidt and The Righteous Mind, and, Jonathan has done some recent work with starting a group called the Heterodox Academy. I'm actually a member of that group, and I think it's one of the things that he was trying to do when he started that was to recognize that oftentimes the perception is, and science tends to come from university settings, okay? And the perception is that universities, at least I've seen this perception expressed, that universities tend to be more liberal in leaning and less conservative, and so and they're leaning. And one of the things that he has been doing is to try to encourage the idea of diversity to move into not just diversity of race or culture or lifestyle or experiences, but also to be ideological diversity, so that faculty and students who are on college campuses who are doing this, participating in these kinds of projects, or maybe even a faculty leading them, that they will actually be able to present alternative kinds of perspectives as they're doing their research, so that ideological diversity would also be valued in ways that other diversity, equity, and inclusion kinds of initiatives also are valuing other kinds of diversity. And I know that that's one of the concerns about some of this research, is that scientists, if they're coming from a liberal leaning, maybe they're focusing on conservatives that are of a certain type and being a little bit more not being making great choices in terms of the samples in their studies. Their choices of methods might be problematic, but so might their interpretations of their findings be problematic if they're coming at it from a more liberal perspective. So I thought you might want to say potentially something about that.
Yeah, I think it is possible, and we've kind of talked about that before when we talked about the research critique. I would say that in most cases, I'm less concerned about the sample selection, other than the fact that a lot of research is done with college sophomores. So that's a kind of a select group too. But what they do when they select, they just basically get the volunteers for the research, and they come in blind, not knowing whether they're liberal, conservative, or whatever. So they just basically get in this big group of volunteers, and then they usually do something like give them maybe a questionnaires to establish that have been used in research previously that's been shown to pretty reliably assess the degree to which a person leans left or right, for instance. And then they take, in order to make sure that we know something is significant for either conservative or liberal, they kind of cut out the ones who are in the middle, and they take the ones that are at least on the, not the extreme far, but at least not right smack dab in the middle. So that way they form the groups based on their self-reported ideological beliefs after they've got them in. So I'm less concerned about that. There probably is a greater potential for bias in interpreting results in a way that's consistent with your pre-existing beliefs. And I would acknowledge that is a concern. So I'm glad that there's being measures taken to get more people looking at various ways. But I also feel that's one of the good things about science, is that the way the scientific method works is that everybody is very open about what you've done. You describe your research process and methodology, and it's open to critique from anyone in the scientific community. And then you back it up by saying, okay, let's do a follow-up study that answers this question we've raised. And that's why I ultimately have a good deal of faith in science as helping us get closer to the truth about what's real and what's going on, even though in any individual situation, there's certainly room for critique.
And, thank you for bringing that up too, because, most science is imperfect. But it's reaching towards a predictability or some kind of hypothesis that can be tested. But even then, there's confidence in the statistical analysis that they do. There are confidence intervals of how confident they are that they would find this in another, another group if they were to get another group that they were testing. And there's never 100% confidence. Right. I mean, you just don't get that when you're dealing with human behavior.
Really, there's not 100% confidence on gravity.
Well,
you can find things in physics that violate those laws too.
But if I jump off a building, most likely.
I'm going to count on that.
Okay, all right.
That's good enough for earthbound work, yeah.
Okay, so I do understand that, in science, because I with social science in particular, I mean, peer reviews, they aren't, you just don't publish something just to get it published without it going through multiple renditions of the last piece that I actually have got published. I think it went through three rounds of peer reviews before, and things that we had to make changes on. And of course, some people could argue that the peer review process is more liberally focused, but I'm not going to go down that road at this point, because I would hope that we wouldn't just, if we critique every single thing about the scientific method, then we have nothing that we can go on. And I know that,
I would argue that could very well be that, the peer review process is imperfect, but the way science works is, as you know, it's not just the result of any one study, but the accumulation of studies over time and with a lot of different people weighing in and doing research to find out what really is going on. So I have maybe short term, there may be more questions, but long term, I feel pretty comfortable about the way science is going to get us where we need to go.
We hope you enjoyed the second part of today's Red Blue Conversation, in which Glenn White and April Chatham Carpenter discussed issues related to a recent series of podcasts on polarization research. Be sure to check out the other parts of the three-part conversation that April and I had, as well as past and future podcast episodes of On the Other Hand. You can find our podcast on the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braverangels.org/podcast, or you can find it on your favorite podcast hosting site. We'd love to hear feedback from our listeners about our podcast, including ideas for speakers or topics. Just email us at otherhandar@gmail.com. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor. From your host, Glenn White, and April Chatham Carpenter, have a good evening, and let's all work to bring our community closer together.